At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing the meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting. Again, my name is Jorge. I'm an alcoholic. And it took me more than just attending one business meeting. It took me three to be able to chair this Saturday night meeting. You know, but I'm grateful because I thought I was not going to chair it at all. You know what happened to me about a month ago. Forced vacation in the Everglades, you know. But I'm back. Thank God to AA and all of you, and it's nice to see people here, you know, that I haven't seen in a while. My sobriety date is May 18, 1993, and it's only because of AA, God, and all of you guys. Thank you for your support again and your prayers and everything that you've done for me. You know, that's priceless. And that's what this, you know, AA is all about. Here you find real friends. That's enough out of me. I ask Marisa to be a speaker tonight. And if you notice, most of the speakers for this month had, except for the first one, most of them had like 3 and 2 years. And the reason why I picked them is because about 3 years ago, I was saying that I was going through hard times. And I had just lost, you know, my business. And a lot of things were going bad. And I was depressed. I was isolating. But I kept coming to meetings. And I remember, you know, Marisa and Keon and a lot of these guys were hanging out. And they were new. They were, you know, they were on like on a pink cloud, I should say. You know, they would go to IHOP and I would go to Starbucks and the Drunken Monkey and all that stuff. And, you know, and I was like, one day they invited me and I said, you know, I need to go. You know, I come to a meeting, I go home, I work, and I'm, you know, feeling bad. And they really helped me more than I helped them. And I really appreciate them. And then they're still here. It's obvious that they enjoy coming to meetings today like I do also. And so with that, I'm going to leave you with Marisa. Okay?
Hi, everybody. My name is Marissa. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, family. My sobriety date is April 21st, 2007, and just like Jorge was saying, it was about 3 years ago. You know, I was talking with a good friend of mine earlier today, and he was talking about some things that I've been going through recently, and he brought up page 52 and We Agnostics, which actually We Agnostics is my favorite chapter in the big book because I had really believed, honestly, for years that I was a very good agnostic and that, you know, I believe there was something out there, but it wasn't anything that what anyone else could possibly tell me could be up there, and I didn't really believe in religion, and I thought all religious people were hypocrites, but I always thought, you know, in the big scheme of things, there was something out there. And so, you know, in that, I went home, and I read page 52, and I cried this afternoon because I was sitting, I was reading, I was praying, because I was pretty nervous to come out and speak here on birthday night because I knew there were going to be a lot of people here tonight. But, you know, it talks about the fact that how we've been unable to have relationships and to be able to hold jobs and to be able to live a life. And it has dawned on me that, you know, this program has really changed my life, not in the sense that I put the drink down. That part, it was easy enough, but in the sense that it's helped me learn how to live life. And it's helping me to continue to learn how to live life. And it talks about how we've all been consumed by fear. And I can tell you that, and in personal experience, and also, too, in the stories that my parents would tell, my grandparents would tell, that I was fearful of my own shadow from the word go. You know, fearful, had all these weird phobias from the time I was born. I would, you know, you would kind of come at me wrong, and I would jump and hide, and I used to hoard food under the bed for no good reason. You know, people would find weeks of aged bread and Doritos and things like that under my bed, because when I was about 3 or 4, I was convinced we were running out of food, and I had no rational reason behind that, that I would hoard things and stuff. And so my folks had thought maybe I was a little different from the word go, but they loved me. And as a matter of fact, you know, working through early sobriety has helped me learn, have a whole different perception of my childhood, and actually, you know, the memories of my childhood have gotten better since I've been sober. They weren't so much when I came in here, because when I came in here, I thought things just happened to me, and I was a victim, and I was a martyr, and my parents, you know, didn't understand me. When I came in here, you know, I had, to some extent, especially towards my mom, I had engaged in a lot of character assassination towards her, because of the fact that, you know, she had battled psychiatric issues for most of her life, and I never understood it. I didn't have the capacity to understand. When I was a little girl, she would sleep 18 to 20 hours a day, and I didn't know why. Or she would be up cleaning the house for 3 days in a row, and I couldn't understand why. You know, and we talk about, you know, the things that we do, picking up the first drink, and how, you know, I can tell y'all how I felt when I picked up the first drink, but I can also tell you that I started alcoholic behaviors long before I ever picked up a drink. And I think when I was about 11 or 12, I think it was around the time my parents got divorced, where I had kind of shut down to the world and had convinced myself that, again, things are just merely happening to me. It's my lot in life, and so I'm just going to get through things. I'm just going to survive and not really get close to people or, you know, and invest myself with people, because I was pretty sure everybody was out to get me, you know. You know, now looking back on it, you know, my family loved me, and my parents did the best that they knew with the teachers that they had, too. And in comparison, my childhood was probably a 50s sitcom compared to my mom and my dad's childhoods. And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was about 8. I was born in Oklahoma, but I spent a big part of my childhood in Northwest Arkansas. And my grandparents had seen that my mom wasn't really well, so they intervened. And I'm very grateful for that, although they had their own little nuances and quirks. But my grandma, you know, she looked at me like I was her joy, I was her partner, you know, I was her project too. She was fully convinced that I was going to be Miss America, that I was going to marry a doctor, that I was going to go to law school, that I was going to have perfect hospital corners on the bed when I made my bed every day. I still have accomplished none of those things, including making my bed every morning. But she loved me, you know, and I think that, you know, especially when I think of moments when God has been present in my life, I definitely think of my grandparents. And I think of, and also too, in the course of the whole religion aspect and the view of God, when I was little, I was kind of brought up to believe that God was something to be afraid of. But at the same time, someone that you were supposed to love and someone that was supposed to kind of give you things, you know. And so my grandmother would always have these little sayings. And so, and I always think, because sometimes when you guys talk, I think of my grandparents, you know, and how much I miss them and how much they would have loved AA. And, you know, things that used to annoy me in the beginning when I first came in here, like, you know, and she'd have this sweet little southern accent. She would say, "Baby, you got to live and let live and let God in and turn it over to the Lord," and I would just cringe. I would just stop it there, you know, because I would look at the kind of lifestyle that people were leading, that they were telling me that I had to depend on this thing that I didn't know was really out there, and, you know, and looking at how they were kind of managing their lives, or they were trying to manage, you know. And I think in looking at all of that, it just kind of taught me, well, you know, I need to be really self-sufficient. I just need to rely on myself. You know, I'm a fairly intelligent person. You know, I can get through things on my own. So, very early on, I had, because things had, my relationship with my mother really deteriorated when I was a teenager. So my whole goal from 15 on was to get out of my house and get out of Arkansas. And I had started another pretty big resentment against my dad, which was, you know, he moved down here about 20 years ago. He was offered a job. You know, a better job than, or it was like a transfer or something to that effect. And, you know, when he came down here, I saw him less and less often. And what I didn't know was that the rift between my parents played a big part in that. My dad did the best that he could, but I didn't really think that at the time. I just thought that he was, you know, my mom was crazy, and my dad was just scared and didn't know what to do, so just took off, you know. So that's kind of how I had felt at the time. And so I'd really felt abandoned. And so he called me one day when I was about 17 and said, you know, hey, well, if you come down, I'll buy you a car. I'll help you through school. And I thought, wow, I'm in. Yes, I can finally get out. I can finally escape from here, because I tried to do everything I could not to be home, not to have to cope with the crushing feelings of fear and anxiety, never really feeling like I quite fit in with everybody. You know, even though it kind of seems, looking back on it, that I had a lot of friends, but I just never really got them. You know, they seemed naturally kind of happy, and they seemed to know how to cope and to handle things, and I couldn't really cope with anything, you know. So when I graduated from high school, I came down here, and then I went to school. And I actually had somehow accomplished a lot of things, and I really don't know how, looking back on it, except that I do know that God played a big part in that. And I went to college. I graduated from a really good college. And I started drinking when I was 18, so I was kind of a late bloomer in that. And I didn't really think that I started drinking alcoholically right away. I mean, I was getting hammered pretty much every night, but it was college, you know, and it was the thing to do, right? You know, and that's what my friends were doing. The only difference was they stopped doing that up to a certain point, and I was just getting started, because, you know, when I drank, I thought I was prettier and funnier, and they had another whole perception of that. My nickname in college was Personality Plus, and it was not a compliment by any stretch of the imagination. You know, apparently I was really obnoxious and a little too talkative, and I tend to push people away. But that's really not how I looked at it. I thought it was great, you know, as long as I had a drink in my hand. And, you know, so things progressed. I actually got a really good job, not right out of college, but, you know, somewhat soon after college, and was making, you know, above average salary for somebody my age, and had a lot of really nice, cool friends. And but I felt empty. I thought, wow, this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to graduate from college. I'm supposed to find the right guy and the right hair color and the right shoes and the right house. And my life is going to just magically be better, and I'm going to be this happy person. And none of that happened. And so still really unable to maintain relationships. And it got to a part, you know, where I played a role in many abusive relationships, especially in my early 20s. And when I was about 24, I was assaulted by an ex-boyfriend. And and going through the shock of that, the following week, it was Memorial Day. It was about this time that year, I was invited to a friend's house, and she was having beers. And for some reason, it was just the best smell. You know, it was I never liked beer in college. You know, I was a fruity, girly drink kind of drinker. But I just wanted a beer, you know, and I stood at that keg, and I had that first beer, and I thought, well, that was so great, so I'll have another one. And then after about 4 or 5 later, all of the fears and the anxiety and all of those things that had haunted me for years had gone away. So in that, alcohol became my God, became my lover, my friend. It was the answer to all my problems. I didn't have to cope anymore. I could just drink like this all the time, you know. And so, you know, led me to, you know, pursue a career path where I could, you know, I eventually went on to sell timeshare, which, you know, for people who've done that know that you can drink endless hours and people won't look at you any differently because they're doing the same thing. And I eventually saw my friends get younger and younger. Like, you know, we were going out with 22 and 23-year-olds, and I was almost 30. And that was a little disturbing, but I didn't really quite pick up on that, you know. And then I just also, too, remember the fact that I was starting to alienate the people that were closest to me. I didn't really, you know, talk to my dad as much anymore. I, you know, eventually stopped speaking to my mother altogether. And it really just, you know, I just figured it was just more stuff happening to me and more people just not understanding me. And, you know, my real friends, the ones that were, you know, drinking with me 10 to 12 hours a day, these are my real friends, and they really get me and understand me, until, of course, the money ran out or things got hard, and then they just, you know, most, not all of them, but most of them took off. And so I think that I hit my bottom. I was encouraged to go to Atlantic City with somebody I'd been kind of seeing off and on. And not really the best place to go if you want to get your act together, but I went. and I was told I was going to make all this money, which I did. I made money, but for some reason I couldn't pay my bills. I couldn't hold on to anything. I was homeless, pretty much homeless when I was up there. The kindness of people letting me sleep on their couch, and I came back here in the fall of 2006, and I was homeless. My car had been repoed. And it still really didn't dawn on me. I mean, I knew that I kind of had a problem, but again, it was just stuff happening to me. I'm a victim, you know. So just random stuff. I have really bad luck. Can't really possibly have anything to do with my drinking. And so I got this phone call one day. I was in Publix trying to cash a check because I lost my bank account too. So this friend of mine calls me and he's like, "Hey, Marissa, I haven't talked to you in a while, you know." And I, at first I thought it was another friend of mine with the same name. I was, "Hey, how you doing?" Then I realized, "Ooh, it's you." And, "Hey, can I call you back?" And it was somebody I used to sell timeshare with. I had a falling out with. And he said, "Okay." And then I wasn't going to call him back. And I heard this voice, this little tiny voice in my head that says, "You know, you need to call this person back." So I did. And he said, "You know, it's been a really long time. You know, I'd like to get together." And I was like, "Oh, hey, let's go to a bar." And he said, "No, you know, why don't we meet for lunch, you know, I've been through a lot of changes. I want to talk to you about it." So we met at a place for lunch and, you know, first thing that kind of threw me off is that he ordered an iced tea, you know, and it was, you know, well in the afternoon. So I figured like, well, why isn't he having a drink? But then I just kind of blew it off and he started talking to me about, you know, the things that have happened in his life and that he had, you know, felt bad about falling out and the rest of it's kind of hazy because it really freaked me out. He put this piece of paper on the table and said that he was working this program of vigorous honesty, that he had this God in his life, and that, you know, he felt that he wronged me in the following ways, and if there's anything I could do to make things right, let me know. And I just kind of stared at him and said, "Oh, you don't have to do anything, you know." And I just, you know, I didn't accept it. And I just thought to myself, wow, this poor kid is in this cult. I can help him. I'm going to stay friends with him because I can help him through this. I know it, you know. Like, this is crazy. Because years before, he and I used to get into these art, because I knew that there's something out there, not a definite God, but something out there. And he could tell me, prove to me that either something that he knew disproved the whole existence of God. And I'm like, what are you talking? So for him to come out here and say all these things really scared me. It really frightened me. But at the same time, like, he had this sparkle in his eyes I've never seen before. So I stayed in touch with him, and he actually helped me get a job. And I was somewhat getting back on my feet, somewhat, but still that hole was there. And, you know, it was getting to the point of, you know, where the alcohol stopped working. And that was very scary for me. And, you know, I don't really talk a whole lot about this, but when I was a teenager, I used to think a lot about, you know, I suffered from a lot of depression. I used to think a lot about committing suicide, but I was never really, you know, I always thought I was too chicken or couldn't really figure out a really effective, painless way to do it, you know. But I was very careless about the choices that I made because I wasn't concerned about whether I lived or died. And I think some of those thoughts had started kind of popping back up into my head towards the last 6 months of my drinking. And of course, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will kind of preface that, you know, there's other stuff involved, and I will just only mention that just to say that because the alcohol didn't work anymore, there was introduction of other substances too, of course, eventually it stopped working too, which also too kind of led me into thinking, well, maybe I don't have a problem because I've only had two beers, but then I'm taking rides with people to Pine Hills, so, you know, but I've only had two beers, you know. So it didn't really, you know, I couldn't put two and two together, you know. So on the night of April 20th of 2007, there's a little holiday among people who smoke a certain substance. It's a 420 thing, you know, hey, it's 420, let's go outside. And so 420 that day, we went to Total Wine and decided to stock up on, and it wasn't like it was the first time I drank at work before, but, you know, it was a weird day because it didn't work. Like, I didn't, you know, we had killed a lot, and I just couldn't even get a buzz, couldn't even, you know. So I was invited to this guy's house after work. I got off at about 9 o'clock at night, and, you know, I had this crummy little boiler room job, but, you know, I was actually making really good money there for the most part. You know, so we took all that. It was payday. We took everything. We went back to his house. And I can tell you, of course, the rationale in my head is like, oh, I only have nachos and a couple of more beers. And I can't tell you guys a whole lot after that. I can tell you what happened was that I did black out and that I woke up the next morning covered in my own blood and my own vomit. And I heard this little voice pop back up in my head. That said, you know, if you don't stop this, you're going to die. Nobody's going to know where you're at, and nobody's going to come looking for you. So you need to call your friend. And all between this whole 6 months, you know, between the time that my friend made amends to me and this time that I'm waking up in a pool of my own vomit in my bathroom, you know, I saw him build a life. You know, he was, you know, employable. He was making friends. He had hobbies. You know, I would call him, and he'd be making calzones or pies or something. I still thought it was a little weird. Still thought he was a little weird, but he was cool. Like I had more of an attraction in terms of wanting to hang out with him and wanting to be his friend, because clearly he had some kind of peace of mind and ease and contentment that I didn't have, that I just couldn't, you know, no matter how much I tried to, you know, take control over my life, I just couldn't get the hang of that. So I called him and he's like, are you all right? And I said, no, I'm not all right. And he's like, are you sick and tired? I mean, sick and tired. And I said, yeah. I said, yeah. I said, I'm done. And so he said, well, there's this. I said, do you still go to those meetings where you read out of that big book? And I kind of envisioned like this huge book that you all like come together and read, because like, he would quote out of it and stuff. And I, that was my thought or whatever. So he's like, yeah, I still do that. And I said, oh, great, can I go to one with you? And he's like, okay. And I said, well, just tell me where it is and I'll meet you. And he said, because he knew me and he knew that I probably wouldn't show up. So he actually came all the way out to Longwood, where I was living at the time, picked me up at 9 o'clock the morning, April 21st, and took me down to a speaker meeting down off of Lake Buena Vista, which is actually next to a bar that I used to go to a lot. So of course I probably could have made it there by myself, but he's right, I would have never driven there. And I'm really glad to see newcomers here tonight, because, you know, my first meeting was a speaker meeting, and it's kind of easy to just to hear somebody, you know, share their experience, and, you know, you can identify with what you can. You know, there's not as much pressure on you, but I really don't remember my meeting that well, except for the fact that I knew that I was separating from the alcohol and that I was shaky and that I was really depressed, and all I could do was cry. And my friend made me read How It Works in the beginning, which I was really angry about. I'm like, I'm new. You're making me read. What is this? You know? And then there was getting these parts about the steps, about these things that we do. And of course we got to this part here, this amends part. I'm like, oh, I'm sure as hell not going to do that, you know? And I'm looking up, and I remembered that part, you know, and just being afraid. Of course, you know, and I wish I could tell you the day kind of ended like that. And he said, no, we're going to go hang out in my house for a while. I think we watched a movie, and then we went to his home group for the 5:30 beginners meeting, and then we stayed for the 6:30, and by then I was really mad by then, because I'm thinking like, okay, one meeting's enough, I don't need any more, I'm good, I really, you know. And so it was great, because a lot of these women came up to me and embraced me right away and said, you know, it's never going to be the same, you could pick up a drink, you know, again, but it's not going to be the same, it's over. And that freaked me out too, but I thought, well, I know somebody who's in my life who's really happy, so I might give this a shot. And if this doesn't work out, then I'm just going to take myself out, because I know the drinking's not doing it anymore. So, you know, and true to, you know, this person who's a really good friend to me is really calling me every 20 minutes over the next 3 days, said, have you found a sponsor yet? And I'm like, but I've only been doing this for 3 days. What are you talking about? He's like, no, you need to get a sponsor. You need to work the steps. And I'm going to call you in 20 minutes if you don't have a sponsor. I'm just going to keep calling you. And I thought, God, stop it. So luckily, I went to this women's meeting that night, and this really sweet little redheaded lady was sharing. And, you know, she was having some trouble with her boyfriend. But then she started talking about the fact, she started bringing up her part in it, which I thought was kind of weird. And it was great, because you know, she's talking about all this stuff, and just the way that she was handling it, I mean, she didn't have a desire to slash his tires, to stalk him, to, like, you know, hire somebody to kill him, you know, all the feelings that I had when I was having relationship problems. She didn't have that, you know, and it wasn't like a, you know, car, you know, house or whatever, you know, she was doing really well for herself, but like it was this coping, this thing that I didn't know how to do. So I thought, wow, I really want what you have, you know, you're not out to get this guy, you know, I really want that, you know. So I asked her to be my sponsor. You know, the thing that, you know, they always talk about in here, the openness, honesty, and willingness. I had two of those, the first time that I worked the steps. The honesty part, was really, really difficult for me. I had a lot of feelings of shame. And then also too, that whole victim thing was like a, kind of like that victim bug was still very much attached to me, and I had a really hard time shaking it. So, you know, one of the first things that she did was she had me come over to her house. She was having these, you know, big book workshops and stuff, and she said, this would be a great introduction for you to start, working the steps. And I had absolutely no problem admitting to myself that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. It was this whole, like, you know, and then it's kind of coming to believe the power greater myself, and then obviously turning my will and my life over to the care of something I'm not even sure exists really bothered me, because immediately I hear that sweet Southern Baptist grandma, you know, turn it over to the Lord, baby, please, you know, and I would just shut down, you know. But I tried, and I had friends in this program that said, you know, if you don't believe in God, my God loves you and believes you're wonderful, pray to mine. And I did, and I prayed to other people. I would pick so-and-so's God today, Bill's God tomorrow, would pray to that. And I really, for the first, probably the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people in these rooms were to some degree my higher power, because I knew that your lives were changing and the sparkle, the light was coming out. Like, there was something happening, you know. So I would pray to that God, because the God that I believed in was either indifferent, didn't want to have anything to do with me, or was totally okay with all this crazy stuff, you know, continuing to happen to me, you know. And the first time I did, I did an inventory. I did a fourth step. It was you could pretty much fill a notebook with it. You know, write down to people that stubbed me in the sixth grade. It was really kind of ridiculous. And I really relished in it, talked about it, and really, like, and I found it the other day, because when I worked with the sponsee and listened to her fifth step, I was going to burn it and I couldn't find it. But the other day I found it. It just magically popped up. And, you know, I was reading through it, and like the why I resented, you know, there was the B's and A-holes and douchebags and like the name calling. I was like, wow, there's some anger. I was really angry. You know, and my first fifth step, and I just thought, you know, my sponsor is just going to rally behind me. And she said, you hurt other people, you called in sick, you stole time from work, you were resentful towards other people's paths to God. And I just pulled back, really? You know, I was kind of hoping you'd be on my side. She says, I am. She's like, I want you to see this pattern of resentment and this fear and this anger that's keeping you sick. You know, during my first fifth step, I hadn't seen my mom at this point for about 3 years. During my first fifth step, I had mentioned about how I had essentially lost all contact with my mother, and, something that I really haven't shared with a lot of people now, but I will share it tonight, was that, my mother's biological father, was an alcoholic, and he got sober in the last year of his life. He died from a stomach cancer and cirrhosis of the liver. But he, on his last year, tried to make amends to my mother, and she did not accept his amends. And there was that part of me that felt the same way. You know, my grandmother used to dress her up, and he said that he would meet her at the bus stop, and she would get all dressed up, and my grandmother would take her there, and she would wait all day, and he would never show up. So I naturally would kind of take this, like, she's been waiting around for me for 3 years, and I'm not going to show up. And luckily, like, I have so many beautiful women in the program that are mothers, you know, who have since told me and have pulled me aside to tell me that, you know, a mother's love is different and the expectations towards our children are different, but it really took me a long time to accept that, and I carried that for a really long time. So even after my first fifth step, I knew I was going to need these Kleenex for a reason. Sorry, excuse me. After my first fifth step, we talked about all my character defects, and they, of course, were all my favorites, and, you know, didn't really want to let go of a lot of them, except, of course, the most glaring ones, the jealousy, the lying, a lot of that. But when it came time to make the amends, I could make the list, but when it came time to make the amends, I couldn't. The fear just crippled me. And then, poof, my sponsor moves. She gets this job in Colorado. She moved out there. And then I went a couple of months without having sponsor, which I would really not recommend at all. I started coming to Central probably about, like, towards the middle end of 2007, and it became my home group about 2 years ago, because I was coming here a lot. And it was about the time I met Jorge and Angel and a lot of these people that were around here. And, in a lot of ways, the fellowship part of this program saved my life, in terms of, hey, you want to go to Drunken Monkey? Do you want to go for coffee? Do you want to go to IHOP? And because my first sponsor said, when they ask for you to do that, you say yes. And as much as I didn't want to, I did, and I would always feel better. But something was really eating at me. And, of course, one of the things I was always taught in the South is no matter how bad you feel, you smile, you put on lipstick, the pageant smile. And everybody around here said, man, Lucy, you're doing so great. And I'm really proud of you, man, you're coming along, And then this really cute little, lady who smiles a lot, glasses, comes up to me and says, so what's eating you? And I was like, will you be my sponsor? And she said, yes. She does the same thing. So I was like, wow, this is great. She knows me. She gets me. And I really honestly felt like that was the first time I could really say that. Somebody gets me, And so we worked the steps again. And then this time I could be more honest. And shared with her a lot of the things I was ashamed about. But what she did was great. She talked about things that she did first, which made me feel good. And I'm like, okay, great, then I can share this, So there are kind of like these pieces missing that kind of slowly filled in when I worked the steps the second time. Most of the, when it came time to do the amends again, for the most part, it was good, except for that amends to my mom, and I really couldn't do it, And by this point, my brother had been helping my mom out, and he had a falling out with her, and she had more or less kind of disappeared, kind of drifted into the unknown. And I didn't know where she was. And I wasn't really, at that time, financially in a financial position to go look for her. So my sponsor suggested these different symbolic amends, like sending a balloon, buying flowers for a lady that I think is my mom, getting cards for people, things like that. And that did work for about a year. I think, of course, doing a daily inventory, I was terrible and inconsistent at. I could get up enough to say a third step prayer, and thank God for Brent, because he says it a lot. And I've killed a lot of brain cells, so it's hard for me to remember things. But he would share every single meeting, and I used to get on my nerves because I'd hear that little Southern Baptist lady again. He was saying it, but then by the time things started to click, I knew how to. I could. There was one prayer I could actually memorize and get on my knees and say. Besides asking, thanking God for keeping me sober and, please keep me sober the rest of the day, those kinds of prayers. And, but I did start working with other women, and I think that the biggest change for me was when I heard a couple of fifth steps, and then I realized how big that ninth step hole was, and it was huge. And I couldn't, it was eating, like those feelings of depression started to come back, and it was eating me alive. So I made a decision. I was just sitting here in a women's meeting one night, and people were sharing, talking about honesty, and I'm like, oh, please stop talking about this, And when it got to me, I had started to cry, and I said, I'm going to go find my mom. It was just as plain as day. I'm going to go find her. Once I made the decision, I had some peace about it. And then my friend, my dear immense friend, had offered to go with me to go do this, because he's like, you're not doing this by yourself. I'm like, I'll be fine. I'll be good. I'll do this by myself. And he's like, no, you can't do this alone. I don't want you to do it. And I really thank God that I didn't, because I'd probably still be up there, endlessly looping the freeways of Tulsa. So about a month ago, well, 3 weeks ago, this is actually very recent, we went up there. And, you know, I, of course, had no address or nothing to really go on in terms of finding where she was. We were going to try to go to the Social Security Administration building. Of course, I'm really thinking we're not going to get anywhere, but he sees a billboard outside, and there's this guy's phone number on it. He said, "You need to call that number, the disability attorney. She's probably called him." And I fought him every season. I'm like, "No, I'm not calling that number." You know, and then grabbed something to eat and decided to call the number, you know, or maybe it was before, I don't remember. But I just know at that time I was consumed by fear. So I called it, and turns out she was a client. They wouldn't give me the information. They told me to go to Hillcrest Hospital. She didn't have the next kin. So, of course, then immediately I thought she was dead, you know. So I went to the hospital, and I told the medical records ladies, "Hey, you know, okay, here's the deal. Here's why I'm here." And they kind of, the one looked to the left and looked to the right and said, "You know, I'm not supposed to do this, but I really hope you find her." And I talked to a friend of mine who's a nurse down here, says that that doesn't happen. You know, I'm like, "Yeah, it does, because God wanted this to happen." And it just slowly kind of started to come together. We went to a meeting, and I shared about why I was there, and there was a retired detective who kind of looked at the address and gave us some instruction on what to do. And it was funny because all these like institutions and people that were on my fourth step were helping me, like lawyers, doctors, cops, Southern Baptists, you know, these people are helping me, you know, and this sweet, and I love Tulsa, and Louis, like, so I can see some Tulsa too. I love Tulsa because they're just so sweet. So they're like, "Oh, I'm so worrisome. I hope you find her," you know, and I forget that because I had very different memories as a kid of what people were like, but then it kind of was brought me to what the reality of with kindness and the generosity of people that live in these little towns like that. So, so we flew into Tulsa at 12:30. And then at 11:30 Friday, the following day, following morning, I was walking into my mom's apartment building. And we had called the dispatch to send a cop car there, and they'd come out and said, "You know, your daughter's looking for you." And she's like, "My daughter doesn't know where I'm at." But she told the neighbor, "So, you know what, go ahead and leave the door unlocked anyway, because you never know." So I knocked on the door, it's still a little fuzzy looking back on it, but I came in and I didn't recognize her, and she recognized me. And I sat down on the bed and I hugged her. And I don't know how long, but it seemed like for a really long time. And I made my amends to my mom. And then I realized I could no longer deny the faith, you know, the existence of God and how he's been a part of my life all along. And I can no longer deny that, because that's just so obvious. You know, it's just so like, you know. Because before it was, I would do the work. Because, you know, my sponsor taught me that the third step was doing the work, you know, and asking for God for help. I could accept that. I could accept doing the work and knowing that God is going to be there for me no matter what. But I just couldn't have faith that he was there to begin with, and then helping me, you know. So definitely, you know, I'm still on my journey as far as, you know, as far as practicing these principles, as far as working these steps and carrying them into my life. Because when I had that conversation with my friend today, that, you know, that this wasn't about the drinking. This is not about the drinking, and I think too often I can sit here and come in here and say that it's fixed my drinking problem, you know, but drinking was my solution. And I had to learn how to live life. And the steps, and all of you in here, and I love, you know, and I love when Jorge shares too, because I've watched you go through things in sobriety. You know, I've watched people's lives get better. My life has gotten better in ways that I couldn't possibly imagine. And when I used to hear people say that, I would think that would be like weird cult talk, you know, coming in. But now I understand what that means, you know. But I have watched people, you know, I have watched dear friends bury mothers. I have watched people go through divorces. I've watched people lose jobs. I have watched people get through these things and have that connection with that spiritual connection with their higher power, with the people in these rooms, and always having that family and always having each other to walk through that, to trudge through that, as it says in the big book. You know, what a miracle that is. And that keeps me in here and seeing newcomers come in here and get better. That keeps me in here too. And it's just the cement, the glue that keeps me in the seat. So, with that, I will wrap it up because it is birthday night and it's not all about me as much as I'd love to talk more. But I definitely thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to share and charge this road with me. Thanks.